Welcome to the Australian Aviation Podcast. I'm your host, Robert Brass, and today on the show, we're joined by Captain Jeff Hay. Like many of us, Jeff had a fulfilling career prior to becoming a full-time aviator. Jeff trained and practiced as a nurse, and he has worked extensively in the operating theatre. Recently, Jeff released his first book on human factors called Ladies and Gentlemen, This is Your Surgeon Speaking. Now, that's a creative title for sure, and it takes a look at modern-day pilot training, particularly in the area of human factors, or the science of why we do what we do. Jeff examines how humans perform under stress in terms of decision-making, teamwork, leadership, situational awareness, and communication. Before we get into the interview today, I wanted to ask you, have you got the latest edition of Australian Aviation? If not, pop on over to australianaviation.com.au and subscribe today. You can pick up a digital membership for as little as $1.49 a week, so head over to australianaviation.com.au and pick up your copy today. Now, today's podcast is brought to you by the Home of Aviation. If you have an aviation business of any type, you need to get your business listed there. We're building the world's largest aviation directory, so come on over to homeofaviation.com and get set up today. As well as your business details, you can share announcements, create events, offer coupons, and most importantly, receive reviews from your customers. Get your aviation business listed today at homeofaviation.com. Alrighty, that's it for the introductions. Let's get into the interview with Jeff. Well, good day, Jeff. Welcome to the Australian Aviation Podcast. It's great to have you here, mate.
No, thanks for having me. Appreciate it.
Well, human factors has got to be one of my absolute favorite things to discuss in aviation. Like all people that are in aviation, we all love the machines, aeroplanes and helicopters and engineering and all the stuff that goes with it. But really, at the end of the day, they're inanimate objects. And the things that make these things fly and make them do what we all love so much are people. So a discussion around human factors is one of my absolute favorite things. Is that something that has been burning inside of you to get out into a book for a long time, or is that something only recently that you've wanted to kind of put down on paper into a book?
Well, no, Rob, this has been burning away for quite a while. I think like any first-time author, this book's taken about 5 years to actually come to fruition. But those ideas, I've been percolating around in my brain for quite a long time. I've been in flight training for 18, 19 years and seen a lot of the human factors side of it progressively get more and more emphasis with pilot training, which is brilliant. But I've also, with my background in nursing and doing some presentations to medical groups, surgical groups, the parallels between the two worlds became more and more obvious as I started to delve into it. You know, we're all teams of humans trying to do the safest thing we possibly can. In my case, for 250 or 300 people, in their case, for one at a time, but the principles are the same.
Mm-hmm.
So to put that simply and practically, it was a real burning urge, if you like, to get that out. But I love doing it in the simulator and thinking about why we do what we do and giving the guys very practical tools to implement that without delving into human factors theory.
Nice. Well, I'm looking forward to this conversation and diving into that in a much deeper way and taking a deep dive into it, actually, because there's a couple of few burning questions that I want to ask the airline captain, the check-in training captain as well, just kind of a thing to me as well. So I'm looking forward to that. But before we get into that, maybe you could just give us a little bit of background on yourself and tell us a little bit about your medical background and then your aviation background as well.
Okay, fairly young, I was one of the first male nurses through the hospital system in Sydney back in the early or the late 70s. So I did general nursing at Royal North Shore Hospital in Sydney, and then I did some postgraduate training in a paediatric intensive care when the Children's Hospital was at Camperdown.
Mm-hmm.
Went to St. Vincent's, and then I moved to regional Australia up near Taree, also when I learned to fly, and worked part-time in an operating theatre up there. So I had a fair bit of medical, particularly exposure to the operating theatre, the intensive care unit, which gave me a nice background for this book. GA, general aviation, like a lot of general aviation pilots, packed up the car and my very few possessions and headed off trying to find a job, which took me up to Thursday Island eventually. I lived on Thursday Island for 2 years.
Cool.
Flying general aviation operations up there, far north Queensland, got to know far north Queensland very, very well. And then luckily, after a little bit of bank freight in Sydney, I got into the airlines in 1989, and I've been in the airlines ever since.
Was that just after the pilot strike? Is that 1989?
It was just before it. And thankfully, the airline I was involved in wasn't part of that pilot's dispute through just good luck rather than good management. But yeah, timing is everything. But that was a lucky one.
Absolutely. And tell me, what were you flying when you were up on Thursday Island? That's a pretty magical part of the world. It must have been remote back in the day as well.
Yeah, it was rather. That was the Britten Norman Islander, which we laughingly used to say lift is inversely proportional to noise because it was very noisy. That's why I'm deaf in the left ear. But it was a beautiful aeroplane to cut lots and lots of weight into heavy and a sort of short strips, both takeoff and landing. So it was the ideal machine for up there. Mm-hmm. So that was the main aeroplane I was flying up there. A little bit of 402 and a little bit of the 206, Cessna 206 as well.
Mm-hmm. Mostly VFR flying, or was it some instrument stuff as well?
Mostly VFR. If you stuck to instrument flying, you probably wouldn't get into a lot of the places up there because the cloud base was pretty low. So we got to know the formations of the Barrier Reef rather well. Mm-hmm. And if you got to know them, they stand out more than any other navigation aid. You've got, bearing in mind that I am quite old, and this is before GPS, I hasten to add. So we had no GPS backup. We just had what was going past the ground or the water in that case.
Very nice. And when you came back to Sydney and you were doing some bank run stuff down here, what were you flying then?
That was an Aerostar based out of Bankstown. And we had quite a few bank runs in regional New South Wales. And you'd spend most of the morning getting to where you were going, stay the day there in a motel, and then spend the afternoon being chased by thunderstorms on the way back to Bankstown with all your bank freight to go home and then do it again the next day.
The instrument flying as well?
Instrument flying. That was definitely all instrument flying. Again, no GPS, no autopilot, no radar groveling around. But incredible experience, though. Very, very, very good experience. A good grounding in aviation all up, really.
So I was going to ask, what was the experience like? And you answered that question there for me, and it was great. What do you see as the younger people coming through the industry these days, entering the airline for the first time? Are they getting a good grounding in the industry, doing stuff up in the scrub up in Northern Australia and PNG and doing the bank run type stuff like you used to, or is it a little bit different from these days?
It's a little bit different lately because we are getting a lot of new recruits in my airline from the regional carriers. So we're getting a lot of people with a lot of experience on Dash 8s and that kind of machine. So they've already had a lot of jet experience. There's still a sprinkling of people coming from general aviation. So that's still happening and the military as well. So those streams, but largely it's more of a regional airline thing now. So the experience base of our recruits is actually really high.
Right. Fantastic. Really interesting. And what about your experience coming into an airline? What was the first airliner that you flew?
That was the 747 Classic. I'm showing my age again. that was as a second officer. So we had and second officers in the airlines have what they call a cruise relief type rating. So we can fly the aircraft in those days down to 10,000 feet. Then we had to get out of the seat and let the captain and first officer take over and actually land the aeroplane. So whilst we did an abridged endorsement and we could fly the aeroplane and the cruise, we missed the bit where you impact on the ground. So that was unfortunate, but it didn't take too long before a first officer slot came up and then jumped in the window seat, and that was on the 767.
Mm-hmm. You went from 7.4 to 7.6.
7.6, yeah, and I had nearly 20 years on the 767. Beautiful aeroplane.
Mm-hmm. And what can you fly an Airbus?
I went on the A330 for 5 years. So, yes, I have been to Airbus.
Very nice.
And seen all that Airbus has to offer. Beautiful aeroplane again. Mm-hmm. And now I'm on the 787 Dreamliner.
Oh, very nice. And is there a preference, or is it just the one you're flying at the time is the one that you love?
There are good bits of both. Sometimes we get very Boeing or Airbus centric, mm-hmm. but there are good, honestly, I can say there are good bits from both.
Mm-hmm. Mm-hmm.
So I've spent most of my career on a Boeing, so I can say that I'm probably more Boeing-centric, but I do admire some of the technology on Airbus as well.
I had a mate of mine recently. He's a 737 pilot and also an A320 pilot. And I asked him the same question, which one do you prefer? And he said, well, it's not really that, it's exactly what you just said. You know, they both have pros and cons. And he said, definitely after flying all day in the Airbus, I get home and I'm about half as tired as when I am flying a Boeing. This is kind of less headspace or hands and feet or something like that. He said he didn't know. He goes, but when I think back and I try and compare how I feel at the end of the day, I was less tired when I was flying an Airbus. Is that something that you would echo that?
Interesting. No, I'd actually say the opposite. Probably because the 787, the way that it's been built, the cabin altitude is so much lower than a lot of airlines. Cabin
altitude
doesn't get it over 6,000 feet.
Nice.
And if you're sitting on it for 15, 16 hours, that makes a huge difference. The humidity is higher and it's a lot quieter. So those three things really make you feel a lot better when you get off. I've noticed a huge difference in flying the 78 versus the 330 and just physically how you feel at the other end.
Mm. Well, you kind of come full circle in all those different types that you can fly from the classic, from the 747 classic, all the way to the very end of the Boeing line here at 787 with the Dreamliner like that. It must be a pretty cool thing to sit in the left-hand seat of that. And just, do you ever pinch yourself and go, man, this is like the coolest job ever?
Regularly. And it is cool. It is a very, very great, it's a privilege to sit in the seat, and sit especially in the left seat of any airliner, but particularly in one as good as that.
Mm-hmm. And what about the performance of the Dreamliner? Does that, you know, when you're doing your flight planning and you're seeing where you're going, does that ever kind of remind you of where it came from? Because it must be so different from what it was to what it is now.
Absolutely. There's a lot of familiarities with the 767 with the Dreamliner size-wise and shape-wise, but where it gets to me is after a long sector, and sometimes in some ports like London, we go down the stairs, get our bags, and we look up back up at the aeroplane, and that really reminds you that mighty little aeroplane has gone 17 hours, sometimes longer, 17 and a half hours, carried all those people and got us there safely. It is a magic aeroplane. There's no doubt about that. That's when it hits me most at the end, not so much at the start because you're a little bit more involved in flight planning and that kind of thing. But at the end, when you've safely got there, to look back and see it, it's a mighty little aeroplane.
Mm-hmm. And what do you think about keeping one eye to the future when we're not far away from 777X, the G9, and getting from Sydney to London in one hop? What do you think about that? That's pretty cool too, right?
Sounds a lot when you put it like that. It is very cool, and I'm sure there's a huge demand for it. I think the flying that I'm doing at the moment is about as long as I really want to do.
It's a long way. How long is it in one hop? It must be like 20-something hours, right?
Oh, I think it'd be over 20, yeah. Perth, London is sometimes over 17 hours. Mm-hmm. Can be a little shorter at various times of the year, but Sydney, London, yeah, the mind boggles. I can't really imagine sitting on an aeroplane for that long, but no, that might leave that to the younger blokes.
I did Sydney to London recently via Dubai, and I got out of Dubai and I felt pretty fresh actually because I was on an early flight from Sydney and then getting, you know, we're out of the airport for, I think we're in the airport for about 90 minutes and I got onto another plane. And then by the time I got to the UK, I was like, all right, I'm ready to get off this thing. I'm done. It was all right because I was traveling on my own, no kids and no family or anything like that. So it was all right. But I can't imagine not being able to get off the aeroplane and sitting there for a full 20 hours straight. You know, it's a big thing. So it's a whole lot of ergonomics and human factors that go into all of that planning as well, right? How many crews are on an aeroplane like that? Is there, there's two full crews, right, that rotate?
Well, there is. And that's the other thing is we're not actually sitting there for that length of time. So there's, on a sector over 14 hours, has four crew. Mm-hmm. You have a captain, a first officer, and two second officers, and you either do team A or team B, or you swap around. But the essence of it is that you're really only on the flight deck for just a little bit over half of that sector. There's a brilliant crew rest on the 787, and I have absolutely no problem sleeping in it. I think the crews have trouble waking me up, but it's you do feel pretty good at the other end. So there is that supports the operation. It's you're still tired at the other end. You're a human being and you've been up for that long. But if you can get a decent sleep in the crew rest, it's really not too bad.
How long do you have a kip for when you're flying? Is it like a couple of hours at a time?
Yeah, it depends. It depends what's happening, what the weather's like and what's going on. Usually you take a short one to start with, like 2 or 3 hours, and then you could probably get 4 or 5 hours in a hit.
Just decent.
If you can get a 4 or 5 hour sleep solid, then you're laughing.
Yeah, very nice. Very nice. And with that lower cabin altitude, you get a long sleep like that. Come to the other end?
No, straight to bed.
Ah. No, the life of the international airline pilot, hey, gallivanting around the world. Yeah, still going.
It sounds incredibly glamorous. It really does. It's usually hotels, ironing shirts, and studying for the next one.
Love it, love it. All right, Jeff, thank you for sharing your background with us there. That's a lot of fun there, and it's what an impressive career that you've had, and I'm sure there's many years ahead of you to keep doing that as well. I wanted to talk about your book because human factors is like one of the favorite topics of mine as a low-time GA pilot. It's something that I'm always constantly reading about, you know, the accident investigations, and I always try and never judge, but always try and put myself in the position of what would I do if I had to make those types of decisions? And as a low-time GA pilot for myself, there's always sometimes I find myself reading an article a little way down, and I stop and I go, what would I do there? And I make a decision, read on a little bit there and go, uh-oh, I found myself in a little bit of trouble there. So I'm going to start off by asking you that one big question. And you kind of mentioned it there at the start, but why is it that people do what they do? Because that's really it strikes at the core of what human factors is. It's why we do what we do. Have you, after writing this book and a lifetime of experience in aviation, worked out why we do what we do?
Gee, if I had that answer, I'd be a lot richer than I am now. But look, it's an interesting thought of sitting at home and analyzing all the data and deciding and armchair flying those situations. The only difference with that is that you're not under the same pressure.
Totally.
Or the conditions that the other pilots in those situations are. And this is why we do what we do, because we're human beings and we're vulnerable to a whole range of things, of frailties, if you like. We get fatigued, we get under pressure, we start to lose the big picture or the situational awareness. And quite often we're not good at communicating that. That then stems onto some of the decisions we make under pressure. And this is why sitting at home thinking about it, you may make different decisions if you're not fatigued or not under pressure or those kind of vulnerabilities. And that's why it becomes fascinating, because they're all linked. The way you decide, make decisions, the way you communicate with each other, the way we work together is all affected by the situation and by the pace at which things happen. And that's the other really interesting thing with human factors, is things develop a rhythm of their own, like non-normal events and engine fires. And you see this in the simulator a lot, that we can create scenarios for our pilots. And quite often the scenario is driving the pace. And what we want to see is the pilots taking that pace back and slowing it down to their brain space. Quite often, if something goes bang in the night, then physiologically we're under startle effect. So our brains have slowed down. All the blood's gone to our muscles to run away from danger. What it's not good at is making clear decisions. So it's slowing the pace of that operation down to basically till your brain catches up, and then moving together as a team. There's no point me being very, very good at what I'm doing if I'm leaving my team behind. And that needs to be communicated too. So all those areas of human factors are all inextricably linked, and they're all sensitive to what's going on outside. So sometimes you do look at air crash investigations or read reports and go, what were they thinking? Why would they do that? Well, under the pressure they were in at the time, that's what they came up with. And everyone's trying to do their best. We've got a vested interest in safety because we're sitting there. We've got that aircraft strapped to ourselves. So we want the best outcome. Sometimes it's hard to decide or try to figure out why people do what they do, but you've got to delve very deeply into the situation before you can come up with that answer.
Jeff, do you guys do any training like at the end of a long shift? Do you ever come to the end at the other end somewhere and then get chucked in a simulator to try and simulate that fatigue? Because there's no other way to simulate fatigue than actually being fatigued and doing it.
No, we don't. Not on a formal basis. No, we do all our simulator training when we're fresh, and it is difficult to simulate that. But what we can do is we can up the workload.
Right.
So we're not upping the pressure in terms of fatigue, but we're upping the workload to make that pressure seem real. And that can be, I don't know how other pilots find it, but after half an hour in the simulator, I might as well be in the aeroplane. Right. I've lost the fact that I'm still bolted to the ground in a hydraulic machine, and I'm so caught up with that scenario that it is really, really a great teaching tool. So you can put yourself under as much pressure as you like in the simulator, and that will show you how that feels. So if that happens in the aeroplane, you go, okay, well, I know that how that feels. I'll put this strategy in place to mitigate that.
I spent a little bit of time in the army way back when, and regular listeners will be familiar with kind of my background as a paratrooper. And you spend a lot of time before I learned to freefall. I was lucky enough to do the military freefalling course. And before you get anywhere near a parachute or an aeroplane, they just drill you, and they just drill you and drill you and drill you and drill you until those drills become second nature. And there's, you know, looking back at it now as I'm a little bit older and in the context of human factors, it was such unbelievably good training. And at the time, it was like the most painful, awful thing in the world, where all we did, you know, for half the day was malfunction drills. You know, you're spinning out of control. You find yourself, you know, out of control on your back, spinning above 6,000 feet. What do you do? And there was a couple of times that I had a couple of malfunctions and got on the ground and didn't even realize I'd had a malfunction because the training was so unbelievably instinctive. And it was a really, it showed me, I remember I had a floating handle once. You know, you think of a parachute, it's got a handle, you pull the handle, military parachute, the handle was floating up under my arm and I couldn't grab it. It's called a floating handle. And anyway, I managed to get the thing off. I pulled it. And normally when you get on the ground, you've got your handle in your hand and you just put it in your pocket, walk in the shed, pack your parachute and off you go again. But this particular time, I picked up my parachute, I walked in the shed, and the rigger looked at me and he said, "Where's your handle, Rob?" And I was like, "I don't know." And he said, "Well, that's $50. You got to pay for it. You know, that's the kind of the fine you get when you're in the army. They sting you for it, sort of thing." And I was like, "Where is my handle? That's a good question. I've never thrown a handle away. And oh, hang on a minute, I just had a mal." And then my mate walked in and he goes, "Man, that just happened. That just happened to you like that." And the training that I'd done had been so instinctive and so good that I'd even forgotten about what had happened by the time I got on the ground. It's got nothing to do with skydiving or parachuting. It's got everything to do with the training that I had there. And there's something going on there in human factors. What do you think?
Correct. All manufacturers have what we call memory items or recall actions. And we do exactly what you were talking about. We drill those over and over again in certain situations where the decision has to be made instantly. And what that does is that does tend to cut through startle effect and at least make the aircraft safe while your brain catches up that 35, 45 seconds of before it can start to think the situation through. And that's vitally important. Some things in flying, you can take a bit of time to decide, and some things have to be done straight away. And the more that you are disciplined to know those memory items, and we're very, very big on testing those regularly in the simulator, that's what kicks in first. The memory item, the aircraft becomes in a safe configuration, and then you can think the problem through there. So most definitely, that's one of the most important parts of aviation. As we say, aviate, navigate, communicate. Well, that's definitely in the aviate section. As you found, that's the first thing that instinctively comes out. Then you can buy yourself some time. It's vitally important.
Absolutely. Tell me, how does it? I can see in just hearing your explanation of long international flights with multiple crew, I can see how there's parallels into the operating theater there, because a patient is on the table sometimes for a very long time and there's multiple people around there and you're standing, you need discipline. There's a whole lot of parallels that are associated with that. Tell me how these things connect. Where's the nexus of that?
The parallels between the operating the theater and the flight deck are quite similar. When I was talking to a lot of these groups of surgeons, I started to realize that A, we're groups of humans, B, we're using technology that's massively rapidly advancing. We have to climb over that, which is a whole other subject. We've also got a chain of command. On the flight deck, you have the captain and the first officer and the second officer. In the operating theatre, you've got the specialist surgeon, you've got his registrars, and you've actually got a chain of command as well. You're all trying to do the safest out for your patients or your passengers. So there's an amazing parallel. The difference, though, is sometimes in the surgical field, in cases of very complicated operations or quite serious trauma, you might have three specialist surgeons all operating on a different part of the body. And it'd be like having three captains on the same flight deck, heaven forbid. But that becomes interesting because somebody has to maintain the big picture of the total picture for that person. So there's a lot of similarities, but the main one is that we are all humans and we're all vulnerable to distraction, to fatigue, to making mistakes. We do make mistakes. We don't expect our pilots to be totally able to not make any errors. It's minimizing the errors and then not having those errors compounding later. That's where the skill comes in.
Mm-hmm. And tell me about the experience of taking all of that out of your mind and putting that onto paper for the first time. Was it difficult to do, or did it kind of just flow out for you nice and easily?
No, that's why it took 5 years.
It was really difficult?
I found it really difficult because, right. You know, especially the longer you leave it, the more you start thinking about other things and the more you're learning and think, oh, no, I'll just add that. And you start tinkering. Mm-hmm. And it wasn't until my wife went to Tanzania. My wife's a midwife. She's volunteering in Tanzania for 3 months that I could actually sit at home and get some momentum on it and start mm-hmm. to, because I just got sick of it after a while, that I just had to get it done. So it didn't come naturally. It didn't flow because I must admit I am a self-confessed tinkerer. At it. But at some stage, you've just got to do it. And that momentum to finally do it, it's not perfect. I read it now and go, oh, no, I should have changed this or that. No, you just got to get the thing done. So maybe the second one will flow better than the first one. But I'm still really, really happy with it. And I still think it's an area that that's particularly the surgical arena could learn a lot from, could benefit a lot from.
Mm-hmm. And what about your pilot colleagues? Have a couple of them read that? What's their feedback been? Were they like, man, I didn't know that you could write like that, or I didn't know that you could do that? That would have been fun.
Yeah, it's been interesting. I mainly got surgeons to proofread it because they're the subject matter experts and they're the target audience. But some of my pilot mates have read it and thought, oh, actually, I hadn't thought about that before in terms of human factors. Because what I've tried to do, Rob, is condense it down into some very usable tools. Mm-hmm. I've even got a checklist, pilot's love checklist, and I've got a little quick reference handbook checklist for every chapter in the book so you can pick it back up again and just revise the questions that you could be asking. This book's got no answers in it. I only pose questions. And all I ask is of people reading it is to say to yourself, well, in my situation, because I don't know everyone's situation, what would I do in this situation? What do I expect of my team, or how do I make decisions under pressure? Just ask the question. The answers hopefully will be supplied by the people reading it.
That's fantastic. Well, looking forward to getting my hands on a copy. I have to confess, I haven't read it yet, but I've done enough research on this interview to know that, but I am definitely going to be reading that. I didn't know that it was just questions either, so that kind of intrigues me even more. If people want to pick up a copy of your book, what's the title? What's the best way to get it? Where can they find it?
Just happen to have one here. It's called Ladies and Gentlemen, This Is Your Surgeon Speaking. And it's available on Amazon and Booktopia, and basically just Google it and it will come up either in a Kindle form, ebook, or a printed copy. The other thing too is it's very short. Mm-hmm. It's only 100 pages. And initially I thought, oh, it might be a little bit too short, but the feedback that I've received, particularly from the surgical fraternity, is they're time poor. They don't have time to read a house brick of human factors theory. They want stuff they can use tomorrow. Read the book. In fact, I had a doctor on board the airplane who helped us out with a medical illness halfway to London.
Right.
And I gave him a copy somewhere just south of India. And when I came back to thank him when we got to London for his help, I said, I hope you get a chance to read the book. And he said, oh, I've read it. I said, really? Was it too short? And he went, no, perfect. That's all I've got time for. But it's short and it's digestible. And I hope people get a lot of benefit out of it.
Fantastic. Well, I'll make sure that the link to your book in Amazon and Booktopia is included in the show notes for this podcast. Jeff, if people want to connect with you directly, what's the best way? Through LinkedIn?
Through LinkedIn. It's just under Jeff Hay, Jeff with a G, G-E-O-F-F, Hay, H-A-Y.
All right, too easy. I'll make sure that that link is included in the show notes as well. Thank you so much for coming on the Australian Aviation Podcast, mate. It's been great to spend half an hour here with you. Look forward to speaking with you again soon, mate. It's bye for now.
Thank you very much.
Well, there you have it, folks. If you'd like to find out more about Jeff's books, just Google Ladies and Gentlemen, This Is Your Surgeon Speaking. And Jeff's name is with a letter G, not a J. So that's Jeff Hay, Ladies and Gentlemen, This Is Your Surgeon Speaking. And I'll make sure that the links to his book are included in the show notes. So if you just peek at your phone, you'll see the links to Amazon and Booktopia in there for his book right there. Well, that just about wraps it up for today. If you have a question, a comment, or an idea for the show, you can reach out at any time via our socials, or you can send us an email to mail@australianaviation.com.au. Well, that wraps it up for today. Until next time, I'm your host, Robert Bruss. Happy aviating, and it's bye for now.